Well, good morning, everyone, and I want to greet each one in Jesus' name. Good to be here with you. Greetings from Oregon. And greetings from the Bible school, too. We're having a good time up there and learning with the students, learning things of God and about God, and growing in our Christian experience and making new friends. Which is really why I'm here, probably. The fact that I, years ago, made good friends at Bible school. Blessing to be here. Blessing to see people that haven't seen in a while. Old friends' faces. And a blessing, too, to experience a church service here where people are being faithful. And walking with God. Trying to do their best to find their way into the will and way of God. Enjoyed the Sunday school class this morning too. Some sobering things there in Isaiah. As David said, we plan to make a hasty departure. I was told to try to get back up there to the Bible school as quick as we can, and so probably won't stick around to visit really. The funny thing is, I think I did that last time I preached here. It was kind of a hit and run. I don't know if it's kind of a tradition or what it is, but when I come here, I got to leave in a hurry. Not typically a good thing to do if you look into the Old Testament, if that had to happen. So, I would like to spend some time in the Old Testament this morning. Think about a man and his uncle there in the Old Testament. A man and his cousin. Another man and his nephew. Characters from the Old Testament. And I'd like to think about the character King David and his nephew Joab. I've been kind of fascinated by the story the last couple days. I've been reading through some of this. And David and Joab. And it's for all practical purposes, they spent their lives together there in the kingdom of Israel. And it's a fascinating life, story of intrigue and danger, and it's a tremendously revealing story in its familiarity and raw humanity, just the way people are. In a lot of ways, I feel like I need your prayers this morning. The things I'd like to point out are things that have been on my mind for a number of years here, and I'm just trying to corral the ideas and maybe some of it is difficult to understand and easy to misinterpret some of what I'll share this morning. And what I'm attempting to do this morning feels kind of complex and easily misunderstood. But I'd like to try. I think it's important for us as God's people in our churches. I think it's important what I'm looking at here, and I would like to be understood. So I'd like to start the story this morning at a funeral. If you want to turn to 2 Samuel chapter 3, 2 Samuel chapter 3, and I'm going to take up the story at verse 31. And David said to Joab and to all the people that were with him, "Rend your clothes and gird you with sackcloth and mourn before Abner." And King David himself followed the bier. And they buried Abner in Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king lamented over Abner and said, "Died Abner as a fool dieth? Thy hands were not bound, nor thy feet put into fetters, as a man falleth before wicked men. So fellest thou." And all the people wept again over him. And when all the people came to cause David to eat meat while it was yet day, David sware, saying, "So do God to me and more also if I taste bread or aught else till the sun be down." And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as whatsoever the king did pleased all the people. For all the people and all Israel understood that day that it was not of the king to slay Abner the son of Ner. And the king said unto his servants, "Know ye not that there is a prince and a great man fallen this day in Israel? And I am this day weak, though anointed king. And these men, the sons of Zeruiah, be too hard for me. The Lord shall reward the doer of evil according to his wickedness." And this was a lament And here was a man who had died. And if you know the story, Abner's life ended with hardness and cold-blooded stabbing there at the gate by Joab. Who was Abner anyway? Who was this man that had died that had so affected King David? Well, Abner was a first cousin to King Saul and the captain of Saul's army. And the first we read of David and Abner together was the day that Abner led David into the court of the King Saul with the head of Goliath in his hand. That's where we first see him together. David, just having been victorious over this giant Goliath. And there they were, Abner and David together in victory. And what a high point in their lives. And those Philistines, how they ran from this man, David and Abner. But the good times didn't last long if we would go back. And I want to take some time and kind of go through this story. I wasn't sure how long this would take this morning, but I think it's interesting to do and it's worthwhile for our attempt. It didn't last long, this good relationship between Abner and David. And it wasn't very long after this that the next time we hear of Abner is on a dark night somewhere in the wilderness. And we find Abner sleeping. And suddenly through the night comes this cry, the voice out of the darkness. Abner, Abner, wake up. What kind of soldier are you? Aren't you supposed to be taking care of the king? Abner, you deserve to die. And here it was David calling. And David and Abishai, Joab's brother. And you know the story how they had snuck into the camp there and stole the spear and the cruse of water while Saul and Abner were there sleeping. And that was the night that he called out to Abner, David. And somehow they had switched sides in this thing. Now David was running for his life from this man that had taken him in before the king with Goliath's head in his hand. And you know, they kind of settled it up there that night in the darkness, and Abner and Saul agreed to go home. And they were going to leave David alone, but David didn't believe it. And you see David, and he turned and ran. Ran until he was safe in the land of the Philistines. And the next time we hear of Abner was in the weeks following Saul's death. You know how they had died there, Saul and his sons and David's great friend Jonathan. And they all died there at the hand of the enemy, but somehow Abner had survived. I wonder already, how did he get through that? How did he make it? Well, the rest of the army was in such tough shape, but Abner was a survivor and he made it through. And as David moved to consolidate his kingdom after Saul had died, Abner, this man, became the official opposition to David. And he took and he set up Saul's son, Ishbosheth, and he created a puppet kingdom in opposition to David. And there was war in the land between the men of Saul and the men of David. And David had been anointed king, and it was God's will that the armies were to follow David. But here he was, Abner, standing in the way with this puppet kingdom. War. And the next time we see Abner in Scripture is at that pool there, in the field of sharp swords, is in translation in 2 Samuel 2, verse 13. And Abner's there, and Joab is there. That's where we see Joab for the first time. It says, "And Joab the son of Zeruiah and the servants of David went out and met together by the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, the one on the one side of the pool, and the other on the other side of the pool. And Abner said unto Joab, Let the young men now arise and play before us. And Joab said, Let them arise. And then they arose and went over by number 12 of Benjamin, pertained to Ishbosheth the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And they caught every one of his fellow by the head, and thrust his sword in his fellow's side, so they fell down together. Wherefore the place was called I can't say the name there, but it means a field of swords. And quite a story. There they were, Abner, the opposition to David, and Joab defending David here against this man, Abner. And if I read the story, it looks to me like there was 12 men on each side. They got up and they stabbed each other and they all died. 24 men. That's the way I read the story there. And it didn't go well from Abner there at that interchange. And Abner turned and ran from that interaction. And he felt himself to be strong when he came there. He realized he had lost, and they had a big battle, and Abner was now running. Abner, the man who was standing against David, and Joab and his brothers, the two brothers, Abishai and Asael, and pursuing him. And Abner ran for his life. And Asahel, Joab's brother, ran after him. And the Bible tells us this man was fast, and I can just imagine him a smooth runner, and Abner was running for his life, and obviously a tremendously experienced warrior. And Asahel, Joab's brother, ran after him and got closer and closer and closer, and Abner's running for his life, And they had this conversation. I wonder what that was like to have this conversation while they ran. And Abner told him, "Who are you? Are you Asahel?" "Yeah, I am. That's who I am." "Well, you better quit chasing me." "No, I'm not going to stop. I'm going to catch you, Abner." We know the story how it ended. Abner, that man, and the back end of his spear, and he just stuck it through him behind him. Asahel, Joab's brother, fell down dead. Very, very dead. What a gruesome way to die. And we can just imagine Joab there coming on the scene. And there was his brother, and he was very, very dead. And who had done this? It was Abner. And there he ran, and we see Joab chasing on, following after him out through the desert. And I can just imagine, you know, here's my brother and he's dead. Asahel is gone. And this is the man that did this to me. And he chased after him. Ran through his tears, through his gritted teeth. "Abner, you traitor. Why could you do that? Why did you do that? Too little, too late to save Asahel." And Abner went on through the night and escaped. And that was Abner. And he made himself strong for the house of Saul. And it was Joab against Abner, good versus evil, the will of God versus the will of man. Abner on the wrong side of history, talented and competent, smart and capable, ambitious and opportunistic. The next time we see him, he's with one of Saul's concubines in an illicit relationship, and he's called out for that, and he was very angry, and that caused him, this man Abner, to switch sides. And he approached David and said, "Can I make a deal with you, David? I'll bring Saul's army into your and Saul's people into your control because I got in trouble for being with this woman. I'll switch side, treachery. Let's make a deal with David." And Joab wouldn't have it. And Joab got back after that deal was made, and he realized what David had done, and he had sent Abner away. And that's where our story started this morning, at that funeral. Joab called him back and said, And "Abner, come back. I want to talk to you." And he killed him. Joab killed this man, Abner, who had been fighting for years, but who had just made a deal with David. And that began kind of a major lifetime of disagreements around people that Joab and David had. And reputations were born there that day. And David wanted everybody to know that this man, Joab, is a hard man. And he's too hard for me, what he did there. And I didn't have anything to do with that. And he insisted that we follow the coffin. And Abner died. And "Abner, you're no fool. Why didn't you watch out for the hard ones?" Awful way to treat a person. And it's almost like he placed a curse on Joab, David did, there in verse 29 of chapter 3. "Joab, you come with me, and, and sackcloth, and let's follow the coffin to the grave of this man that you killed. What did Joab think? You know, Joab, he turned out to be a warrior. And he turned out to be somebody that David needed. And David, the next time we see him, you know, it's for the Ammonites. And we needed somebody that was competent and could handle himself and was a warrior and could fight. So he sent him out there to take care of the Ammonites. And soon David needed him for something else. This time, something quieter and a lot more sinister. And one day Joab got a letter handed to him. And my words to the letter, it went something like this. Joab, I know you're busy there with the Ammonites, but I have a problem. You see, this lady there at home is pregnant. And we can't have this all over the front page. And Joab, Uriah really needs to disappear. That's what needs to happen. We just need to end this. And it was signed by David. David signed that. And so, Joab being the man he was, it happened. And it was smooth. And it was done with the competence that you would expect from someone like Joab. And no one would have ever known, I suppose, except that God knew. And David's version, too bad. The sword takes one just as well as another. And we could ask the question, who is the hard man now in the story? Who is hard and unfeeling? And which one of those murders, Abner or Uriah, would you prefer to be responsible for? And as time went on, they went on together, Joab and David, with very different views on people and on the people they interacted with. And soon it wasn't too long here till the king in the story had a much bigger personal problem. Long story. Out of control children. Rape and revenge. That turned out to be murder in his own family. And David crying his eyes out every day for his dead son Amnon. And Absalom there in exile. Banished over there with his relatives. Life wasn't going so good for David. But Joab, he was there. And tremendously perceptive and tactical. You see that story, it's a very interesting story about him going and getting this wise woman, Joab doing it, and setting up this interaction with David to trick him into seeing what he was really like there. Joab could tell. Joab, who's decided he was going to try to help. He's going to try to help David come to grips with his own heart. Help this man who was stranded by these mistakes and these relationships that were a mess. Joab can help. Joab, that hard man, was willing to try to bridge the gap between a man and his estranged son. Joab, that man who was a relational nightmare. Joab, whose self-perception was of a man who saw life as it really was. He was not an illogical prisoner to hope. He was not a pie-in-the-sky purveyor of sunbeams and moonlight. Life was as it was. Absalom and David, what a disaster in the making. And so he called him back, and he worked it out, and Absalom came home. And it didn't work. One morning, Joab looks out, and his field's on fire. The whole thing, barley field up in flames. And his field's on fire because Absalom can't get along with David. And so Joab set up the meeting, and the niceties were said, and the kisses were passed out, if you look up the story. And all the right things were said, and the smiles, and we made up and went on. But it only went downhill from there, and it turned out that it wasn't better. And Absalom and David hadn't figured it out. And Absalom started in on a continuation of his very long list of bad mistakes. Absalom, and 40 years of pretending everything was okay with Dad, 40 years of undermining and undercutting and self-promotion, and suddenly we see David running for his life. Absalom has made a move on the kingdom, and now David is being pushed out. And we see the man Shimei there cursing still from Saul's family. And Absalom there, once David was gone and the army was still there, Absalom chose this man Amasa to take Joab's place running the army. And then you see David there, out pushed out, and he's across the river, and who does he look to for help? Well, he looks to Joab. Joab called on again to find his way back, to somehow fight the battle and make this thing come out okay, Joab. As Joab looked back there at Absalom and Amasa, his cousin, there, leading my army against my king. And so they're prepared to do battle, and just before they go out to do battle, and Joab is about to risk his life again for this man, David, his friend, David tells them something. He takes the leaders of the army aside, and he said, listen, be careful with Absalom. Deal gently with this young man. Risk your lives, but don't hurt him. Don't hurt Absalom. And we know the story. And they went to war. And pretty soon, there he was, Absalom. Crazy long hair caught in an oak tree. How do you end up trapped like that? A bad man. On a dumb mule. On the wrong side of history. And what did Joab do? We know the story. 3 darts. Right in his heart. And he wasn't going to let him off easy. And he didn't let him get away. And he just fixed it then forever. This man, Joab. David there. Now we're in 2 Samuel 19. Uncontrollable sadness. My son Absalom, would God I had died for thee. O Absalom, my son, my son. And Joab heard about it. Joab heard about how David was acting towards the story of Absalom. Joab, who had just risked his life and his army and lost men and friends, trying to recover from this mistake that had turned Absalom into what he was. And we see in verse 5, Joab coming into the house where the king was, and he said this, "Thou hast shamed this day the faces of all thy servants, which this day have saved thy life and the lives of thy sons and of thy daughters and the lives of thy wives and the lives of thy concubines, in that thou lovest thine enemies and hatest thy friends. For thou hast declared this day that thou regardest neither princes nor servants. For this day I perceive that if Absalom had lived and we all had died this day, then you would have been happy." The wrong people want is how you're acting. Terse and sarcastic You better get your act together, gather up all this nonsense, and come out here and thank us for saving your life. Stout words from a hard man. Is that what it was? Life went on. Amasa, this man who had been just hired as Absalom's commander-in-chief. David let him stay on the job. And you know who he replaced there as commander-in-chief? He replaced Joab. No, Joab didn't have a job. Here he was, the man who had just fought against Joab for Absalom, replacing him, and David was able to just blend that. Merge Amasa and his disloyalty into the future somehow. Amasa, clearly the wrong side of history. And then one day, there was a new battle to fight, and something came up, and he needed somebody to run the army, and so he sent Amasa to do it. David did. Chapter 20. Verse 5, we find this. And Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he tarried longer than the set time which he had appointed him. And David said unto Abishai, now shall Sheba, this enemy, do more harm than Absalom did. So go take care of it, because Amasa can't do it. And so Abishai there, Asahel's brother, Joab's brother, started in. And who do you think came to help him? Well, Joab did. And we find another very sad story in verse 10 there, chapter 20. Joab came up to this man who he felt was disloyal and was on the wrong side of history. And Joab again just killed him. Right there on the road, a very painful way to die. And it isn't very long, and with no fanfare, Joab is back in his job running the army for King David again. We can go on the story here, how David needed these men. Verse 17, Abishai, Joab's brother, saved David when he was almost to get killed by a Philistine man there. And we go on in the story. We find Joab trying to talk David out of numbering the Israelites. David, it's a bad idea. I don't think we should do this. And David wouldn't listen and overran what Joab was trying to tell him. And turned out to be a disaster for David. He caused great harm to the children of Israel. And the end of their story together here in 1 Kings 2, 28 to 34, I'm going to read this. It says, then came tidings to Joab, for Joab had turned after Adonijah, though he had turned not from Absalom. And Joab fled unto the tabernacle of the Lord and caught hold on the horns of the altar. And it was told King Solomon that Joab fled unto the tabernacle of the Lord, and behold, he is by the altar. Then Solomon sent Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, saying, go fall upon him. And Benaiah came to the tabernacle of the Lord and said unto him, thus saith the king, come forth. And he said, nay, but I will die here. And Benaiah brought the king word again, saying, thus saith Job, and thus he answered me. And the king said unto him, do as he hath said, and fall upon him, and bury him, that thou mayest take away the innocent blood which Joab shed from me and from the house of my father. And the Lord shall return his blood upon his own head, who fell upon two men who were more righteous and better than he, and slew them with the sword my father David, not knowing thereof, to wit, Abner the son of Ner, captain of the host of Israel, and Amasa the son of Jether, captain of the host of Judah. Their blood shall therefore return upon the head of Joab and upon the head of his seed forever. But upon David and upon his seed and upon his house and upon his throne shall there be peace forever from the Lord. So Benaiah the son of Jehoiada went up and fell upon him and slew him, and he was buried in his own house in the wilderness. And that's the end of the man Joab. He died there that day in the temple. And Solomon completed the commandment that David had given him. If we look back, we see that David told him to do this. Two people to take care of when I'm gone. Joab and Shimei, this man who cursed me. Take care of Joab, David. Make sure Joab is held to account for what he did to these two men. And there they lived their lives together. And how is it that these men ended up on so different sides of all these relationships that they encountered? The title of the message this morning is Beyond Relationships. Beyond Relationship. And without question, there is a tremendous difference between how Joab viewed various individuals and how David viewed them. And what can we learn from the fact that as they went through life, David constantly viewed Joab as a hard man, while seemingly constantly Joab was digging David out of various scrapes, problems, over his head. Couldn't handle what he was up against, and Joab was called on to fix it. Was Joab to blame? Did David make mistakes? How come they were on such different planes with people? Have you ever done church with a hard man? Have you ever done church with a hard man? Someone who, in your experience and from your perspective, it was just always T-bone and always fix it and always way too deadly. This hard man. All my life, and here's where maybe our perspectives. I've noticed in preaching in different settings today, I have to be careful because everybody's perspective is not mine. And so I'll leave you yours, but this is mine. All of my life, I have been taught the benefits of relationship. Carefulness, commitment to relationships. We've got to work it out. We've got to get along. It is tremendously important to take care of our relationships. And daddies, please maintain and keep a relationship with your children. It is vital for their good. All my life. And I'm just old enough to be aware of my grandfather's generation ending and the leaving of conference. And the fellowship lines, and the standing against apostasy, and the legacy of division of my grandfather's generation. And I know I'm getting old because the other day at Bible school, I asked my class of 20-some students, how many of you know what the Iron Curtain is? I'm going to ask for a raise of hand this morning. How many of you know what the Iron Curtain is? Look at this. A fair amount of these people up front don't even know what it is. That's surprising to me. Look it up sometime. It's important. Fellowship lines. Standing against apostasy. Legacy of division. And let's just, people are falling out. And if that means that we're going to end relationships, we will just do it all over the place. It just does not matter where. We are going to stand for truth. My grandpa. And my dad lived through three church divisions before he was 18. And he knows what it was like to walk into the council room at communion and just be set straight for his failures to be what he should be. And so I've just been aware of the switch between the generations. And all my life, I've been taught good things by my dad's generation about relationship. And I'm in no way minimizing the good things that I have learned. And it's been good for me, personally, because of my personality. It's been good for me. Get along, relationship, work it out, commitment. And so then, is it fair for me to ask the question, is this serving us well? Is it possible, even, to overemphasize relationships? Can it matter too much to us to get along? And if it were possible to do that, what would it look like? If we were to make that mistake, what would the results look like? So I've been doing a lot of thinking the last number of years on that question. Beyond relationship. And mistakes that I think perhaps are possible and perhaps we're making. And some of the things that might have be causing for us. And these are in no particular order. And in a lot of ways, they are my opinion. I'm open to be corrected on this. But the things that I see, as I think about our churches. And you know what? A couple years ago, I started keeping a list of all the young men and women in the Western Fellowship and the Bethel Fellowship, friends of mine, from my age and 20 years younger, who have somehow lost their way. Found themselves somewhere else, either far from God or in a situation that we could not bless doctrinally or application-wise. Started keeping a list. What happened? Beyond relationship. I've got 8 things down here where relationships can go, the emphasis that I believe that can go wrong. Number one is the failure to see righteousness in ending relationships. Is it possible that it can become so taboo to end a relationship that it's never right? It's just never okay. Never a righteous thing to do. Never a righteous thing to do. Now, I'm not talking about some kind of bad blood, red in the face, walk away slamming my doors kind of behavior. Certainly not. There's baseline Christian conduct, which of course we must maintain. But nevertheless, to just make it real for someone that you're going your way and it's not my way. It's a different path. And they don't go the same way. And because of that, our relationship is coming to an end as it was. Relationship becomes a right. Something that I can demand of you. Not something that I can earn or that I can lose. I wonder if we've so emphasized it that it's no longer righteous in any case to end it. Some of these you're just going to have to think through for yourselves. I have to hurry on here. Number two, believe and trust itself as a magical formula. Believe and trust. Give them the benefit of the doubt. Show trust in them. Believe in them. Give them the password. Let them do it themselves. Believe and trust. And somehow, to be doubtful or distrusting, and we just must put blinders on to the reality of what's happening. We just have to choose to trust. That's our only option. It's some kind of magical formula that's going to work out somehow. Is that a mistake we could be making? Number three, we could be, or through this preservation of relationship, could we become the vectors of cheap grace, an enabler of unrighteousness? And the accountability meetings, they go on, and they go on, and they go on, and it's the same, and it's week after week, and the things are made right, and they become a professional at it. And finally, you must realize there's very little difference between our accountability meeting and the Catholic confessional in town. It's almost the same. We meet with the priest, and they make it right, and we go on, and we do it again. It's a way of life. Vectors of cheap grace. Number four, a self-perception of accuracy around mercy. Self-perception of my accuracy when it comes to mercy. And those men around you, that Joab, that's a hard man. And he's hard, and he's always hard, and he's every time. But I've got it right. And my view of mercy is accurate. I understand. And here's a deep one. Take some time with it. You, through that emphasis on your mercy, you usurp the role someone else's relationship was meant to fill in that life. Your emphasis on mercy has caused you to usurp the role someone else's relationship was meant to fill in that life. Number five, self-appointed experts at interference and correction. I have this to say. I wonder sometimes, the intractable nature of many of our church issues has much to do with interference and correction. Me trying to help someone to see something different. You trying to make a change in someone's life. And calling them into account and taking relational risk to do so. Saying, friend, you've got a problem. And I really think you need to change. You're making a mistake here. Only to have someone step in beside you and say, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if it's so bad. And have someone else step in and take that kind of a smug adult in the room perspective. Middle ground here. Let's. Is it really this serious? Interference and correction. Number six, inability to cope as relationships crash and burn. You do not understand why mercy alone does not fix it. How come it didn't work? And I just see David in that as he looked at his son Absalom and just kind of the emotional meltdown that he faced once Absalom was gone. What possibly could have went wrong? And it just crashed and burned around him. Inability to cope. Could it be that problem, the inability to cope and to never be able to walk away, is the reality that you cannot bridge the gap. You cannot bridge the gap between unacceptable behavior in someone's life and the irreconcilable differences that that causes. And I know a man who faced some things in church life and committed to relationship and it's got to work out, and we've married to the church and commitment and good things around relationship and faced with behavior of some people who was out of line And I knew from his convictions that he would never go along with that. And it was not okay. And he couldn't be good with that. And yet his convictions told him that he has to be committed to relationship. And in this, he couldn't bring them together. He couldn't bring them together. And somehow his commitment to relationship was such that he could never end it. And recognize that behavior, godless behavior, is a relationship-ending reality. That's what happens. If you're stuck there between unacceptable behavior and irreconcilable differences, and you can't bridge it, I wonder if your concept of relationship is what it ought to be. An enabler of unrighteousness, number 7. Emphasis on relationship. Enabler of unrighteousness. And finally, we must, well, it's like the old saying goes, what you allow is what you believe. What you allow is what you believe. He's doing this because you let him. And because we've got to make the relationship work out somehow, we can never come to a definition of apostasy. When enough is enough, and it's just one step further, and one step further, and we can never get to the end of it, because if we got to the end, that means the relationship is over. Has to be. Because then they become the world. And then once they're the world, I can't be their friend. Or I'm a friend of the world. And we can never make the step. We never call it what it was. And we lose our ability to discern when someone has lost their way. And we, with our walk, become this enabler of unrighteousness. And the last one I have here is to create in others a desperation reaction of decisive action. Your emphasis on such a good thing as relationship, if taken too far, can create in others a desperation reaction of decisive action. I think we see that in Absalom there with the story of Amnon. And David knew about it, and he knew what happened with Tamar, and he knew who did it, and he knew when it happened and what was done. And nothing happened. And he was never called out. There's never any repentance. He didn't make it right. And he just went on somehow. Absalom, when faced with that reality, took him out. Got rid of Amnon, his brother. Joab. And maybe you could give me some feedback on this. Abner, this man that David was so lamenting. From my perspective, completely on the wrong side of history. How could David be so supportive of someone who Joab had just spent years trying to fix the problem? And we find Joab at the end, you know what, David? Nonsense. And it doesn't make sense. And you can't make it make sense. I'm done with him. And their reaction. You know what's sad about that idea? Is if history does what history does, if we are raising a generation of over-relational people, the reaction to that, what is that? A generation of division like you've never seen. Because that's the way pendulums work. It was Grandpa. And he left the conference church with all the truth and the reality and the difference and the right things that whole generation did to what now is Mennonite USA with its gay marriage in the pulpit. and the pendulum swings to where anything goes. And then it swings back. Are we in danger of creating a tremendously divisive generation? People who don't see a need to get along. Who've seen relationship ran so far that it's senseless. Who've seen it taken to where you live your life and I'll live mine. And we'll all be happy together. I'm out of time, and I want to say thank you for listening this morning. That's some hard stuff. Maybe not something we hear every day, and like I said, I'm open to being corrected. But you know, there's kind of a deep sadness with me. When I think of this missing block of people in our churches, it's unusual. What happened? May God bless you.